Welcome to another life-changing message from Pastor Vernell J.R. Samuel of Hungry for God Church. For more information, please visit our website, www.h4gchurch.com.
Hello everyone, my name is Jitali Bellington. I'm a youth financial literacy coach and an author of a youth financial literacy book. The book is Wants Versus Needs, Kidpreneurs. It's all about financial literacy awareness and entrepreneurism. I feel like, especially in communities of color, that entrepreneurism is a lost art. You know, the days of the trade where people had something to fall back on if, let's say, they were fired from their jobs, that has been a dying art. So I kind of want to push back towards making sure our youth have a second chance of not just being financially aware, but also being entrepreneurs and understanding that they have an art and they have a God-given gift that they can lean back on, 9 out of 10 of them. And if they don't have something that they feel like is an art that they already have, helping them find something that they can become and turn into an art and hone it. So, and then my background is 13 years in finance. I did 9 years investment banking. I did ETFs, so I have my Series 7, so I've been in the stock and bonds world for 9 years. And then I did 4 years of forensic accounting for companies like Marc Jacobs, Oscar De La Renta, Roberto Cavalli, the list continued, and Gucci, and these people hired me to make sure their accountants weren't stealing from them. And unfortunately, I learned in that situation 3 things, that the rich don't pay full price for anything. In fact, they get a lot of things for free. And the second, you know, the second thing I learned was that the people who made $300,000 to $1 million a year were the ones who stole from the company the most in comparison, and they were still like $20,000. So they would lose a $300,000 salary or a $700,000 salary when for $20,000 in essence. Meanwhile, the people who made $30,000 a year were afraid to take a paperclip from the job. And the third thing I learned in that situation was as well that you have to properly structure yourself. No matter what you're doing in life, whether you're working for a corporation or a school, you have to properly protect yourself because the rich, you know, we look at them and we look at someone like Trump and we say, hey, he doesn't pay taxes or anything. You know, all he does is deduct, deduct, deduct. But in essence, that is the game of America, is knowing how to properly protect yourself and deduct. So that's who I am.
I hear a little British accent.
I'm from Manchester, England. So we speak the Queen's English. We don't speak the Harry Potter English. I'm not going to talk like this. That's just not me. So, you know, it's more of a relaxed Brit English.
How long have you been?
I have like a love-hate relationship with New York. So I'll live here for like 1 to 2 years, and then I'll go back home and like I'm tired of this cold. And now I have a son who's 2.5, so this is technically my longest stretch living here. But even then, I get breaks because America's winter is no joke, you know. So it's about time to leave.
I like England, but it rains too much.
See, that's London that rains too much. I'm from Manchester, we get sun. So, definitely. Quick story, I lived in London for 3 years, and when I lived there, I remember being depressed. And I was like, you know what, let's break this up and move to New York. because I just felt like it was raining, dreary and cloudy all the time, and I'm used to sun. And but then coming to New York, I didn't realize how expensive flying away from New York would be. Whereas in England, every weekend when it was wintertime, we could spend like $60 and be in Spain, and you know, we're living a good life. But here, you want to go to Spain from New York, it's like $3,000. I'm like, are you bloody kidding me? So with that said, man, we need some change over here, some global warming to warm it up, not freeze it up.
Awesome. So how did you get into finances? Like, when did you know that that was a calling of yours?
Interesting that you asked that question first. So, to get deep, I came from a split household. My mother, my maternal mother, passed away when I was 3. And then my dad and his wife separated when I was young. So my stepmother, when they broke up, moved to New York. And I stayed in England with my dad. And when I stayed in England with my dad was kind of like the silver spoon life. He was a barrister in the UK, so he's a lawyer. He was into finances and money, and he represented the Queen. So anytime someone British would get in trouble in the world, they would send him a lot of times, especially in like in Africa. And then my mother was a complete polar opposite. My stepmother was a gambler, and she financially was unstable, and she rented from like basements to rooms in people's houses. You know, it was, she was the cliche of what you should not be in life. So when I would come visit my stepmother, my dad would send me money and send me with money to New York to visit her, and I would be here for like say a month or 2 months, and she would take the money from me, and then she would go gamble it. You know, or she'd buy drinks because then she would lose the money that she gambled and she couldn't pay the rent. And, you know, I would notice this battle within her. Now go back home to England, like, I do not want to become this person. And that's kind of what perpetuated and pushed my need to know money and understand currency and understand finances and not become that person. You know, every one of us in this room, we have a narrative and we're given a story. And then it's up to us to decide if we're going to allow that story to steamroll us. Are we going to take the bad and cling on to it and make it become our story? Or are we going to take that and learn from it and not become that person? So at 16, I got a paid internship at Credit Suisse First Boston. And I was in high school and I was going to be graduating early. And at 16 years old, when they gave me the opportunity after my summer internship to stay as a paid intern, I was like, have no personal life, but go to work and learn more from experts. Or, you know, enjoy my youth and stay in high school and whatever. And I decided to, you know, suit up and go to work after school. So I kind of lost that fun time when kids were going to the movies. But at that same point, it pushed me into rooms. And it just reminded me that there really are no barriers except for what we give ourselves. Because at 16 and 17 and 18 and by 19, I had my Series 7. And I was in a room with people who were triple my age and who I never imagined I could have been in that space before. And I was learning from them, and I was learning from, you know, from Jewish to Italian to Russians and black people who were affluent. And, you know, it was just something that for me let me know this is where I needed to be. And, you know, after a while, it stopped being my fear that was driving me, and it became my love that was driving me. So that's how I started.
Wow. So, where, because obviously you see we're a people of color here, and here in America specifically, we're considered a minority, and you know,
the
terminologies that this, that, yeah. You know, the things that come along with that, because if we're minorities, then who is
the majority,
right? Mm-hmm. And so, when it comes to empowering our people, what's some of the, if you can say, like, some of the, like, most basic hurdles or challenges that you come across when it comes to helping us increase or improve economically?
The first thing I noticed is wants versus needs, which is why when I wrote my book for youths, I created the first theme to be wants versus needs. I feel like as a child, if you're not taught that money does not grow on trees, you know, your parents sometimes yell at you, but then let's say they gave you a budget for lunch and your budget was $50 and you spent it, you go to your parent, they might cuss you about it, but then they're still going to give you more money. then it starts to create this in your mind, like, well, if I need it, it will be there. But realistically, that is not the case. You know what I mean? It's not going to always be there when you need it if you don't budget it properly, if you don't monitor it properly, if you're not investing wisely. And then that leads me to my second thing is the importance of investing. You know, people think you need to have $1,000 or $5,000 or $20,000 to invest. You can invest with $50. You know what I mean? Like right now, everyone's looking at the whole Bitcoin and cryptocurrency wave that's happening. You know, some people might not want to go into it. It's a bubble. It's gonna burst. But depending when you enter that bubble, then you might be financially well off right now. It was at one point at $1, you know, and now $16,000. It's always about watching the curves and analytical and being able to see what's happening. You know, a story that I like to share is I taught my 16-year-old nephew when he was 15 how to properly pick penny stocks. And he picked a penny stock that by the time Trump became president, basically in 1 year, he made $10,000. So he made his first $10,000 at 16. And then he said, you know, auntie, what do I do with the money now? And then within 6 months, we were able to get him to buy an investment property at $15,000. You know, we had to give him the $5,000 difference, but we taught him the tools needed to purchase a property and purchase real estate and understand the power that he has as a consumer. And then I think the next thing I would also say that is important for people of color to understand is that it's okay to take money from the other side. Because, you know, sometimes as a conscious community, we're like, oh, we have to only buy and get from the black community. We have to wait for a handout from the black community. We have to, that is not the case. You know what I mean? There are a lot of funds and grants that are here that the government has. You live in the country. So use it at its best potential. You know what I mean? How would you feel if I told you there's a grant for being a woman with curly hair? There's a grant for being a woman with breasts. There's a grant for being a man with an accent. There's almost a grant for almost anything that you can think of as long as you're willing to go through all of the grants on the websites and find the one that better suits you. You could submit for 20 of them and get like 5. You might not get all 20 of them, but keep submitting. You don't have to properly know how to write a grant to get a grant. You know what I mean? There are grant writers. And sometimes you can even find someone who's an intern who wants to just do it for free for you because they like your vision. Because if you believe in your vision and you believe in yourself, then it's going to be easy to have other people who believe in you. So those are the top things. And I've noticed, especially when I moved to New York, like in England, we don't, as black people, look at ourselves as a minority. We just say we're Afro-British, right? And, you know, we claim our African and we claim our heritage and we know our rights. We're always talking about our rights and we're quick to petition. We're quick to rally up and start signing petitions. And we know that our voices can be heard. But here in America, I feel like people tend to say, especially in the black community, like, what's the point of doing a petition? No one's going to listen anyway. Our voices don't count. But then look at what happened. What was it, in Alabama? They voted a man in. It was the black women community that helped that man to be elected. So our voices can be heard, and our voices are important. You just have to believe in it as much as you believe in some of the finer things you like to purchase or the celebrities that we watch. You know what I mean? Because the only difference between you and them, honestly speaking, is the fact that they believe in themselves. And sometimes you're in a room with them, you're like, oh my God, that person's so cocky. But it's that cockiness that got them to where they are. So there's no need to hate on them, you know. I won't say the celebrity's name, but there was this one time I met when I was younger, maybe 10 years ago, I met this one celebrity and she was just starting and her attitude was like beyond her. You know, she wasn't where she is now. And I was just like, she's so disgusting. And she like, kind of was like, this is too cold for me. And I was just like, ew. And then I remember kind of throwing hate on her in the sense that I remember walking away and people were like, oh, you met her, how was she? And I was like, oh, she's so nasty. And you know, and then I don't remember when it exactly clicked, but like 3 years later, I remember I was at a conference and I was having one of those days and I was just aggravated and somebody asked me for my opinion on something and I was just like, I don't have time for this right now. And then as I'm walking away, I heard him say, oh, she's so nasty. And I was like, oh, I just got like pegged, right? And it just made me rethink about it. And I remember thinking, like, I need to relook at the way I view people. I know you for 2 minutes. Maybe you're really nice to your life, who knows? But I don't know your story. And I forget sometimes it's that nastiness, it's that cockiness, it's that energy that gets us to the next level. So we need to be sometimes aggressive. We need to be, when we're in a battlefield, as feisty as our counterparts.
Yeah, so. I like what you said. Because it's about becoming positively aggressive about success, right? That it's not just going to be handed to us, right? Nothing in life is just handed to us. And there's just this sense of entitlement that a lot of people have today where they kind of feel like, I can become successful in a week. You know, I can make a hit. I can do something and it goes viral. And once it goes viral, everybody will know me, and I'm famous now. And there's that's happening with people today. But I wanted to piggyback on something you mentioned about investing, the importance of investing. That's one area. Because I didn't grow up around money. I didn't grow up with a silver spoon in my mouth. But I was able to have parents who made sound decisions. I watched my parents' budget. I watched my parents tithe to church. I watched them. You know, I grew up around this whole wants versus needs thing. Like, the things I wanted, I didn't get, but I got what I needed. And so I always knew I can count on my parents to make sure that they will provide what I needed. Fast forward to where I am in life today, I have no problems expecting for my needs to be met. But there was a new desire in me, a new hunger in me for more. Not because I want more for myself, but I want more because of the opportunities and the power it will be able to give me.
But there's nothing wrong for wanting it for yourself, just to put it out there.
Right, okay. you're right. And that's even something I'm learning to do, because I've learned how to settle for, and it's funny, Bianca was talking about that. I learned how to settle for just enough for me, and enough for my family, but I had to learn. Now God is teaching me how to want some things. It's okay to want. The Bible says, He's my shepherd, I shall not want.
Abundance is your blessing.
Amen. So abundance is my birthright, it's who we are in Christ, but I had to realize, I'm like, where did that come from? Like, where did that come from, that train of thought for me to accept not having more than enough, just to accept
the same people who called you a minority.
Exactly.
So, I mean, the reason why I created, so fast forward to present day, my financial literacy initiative, we have a finance curriculum, and thank God, this year, 2017-2018 school year, we're going into 93 schools so far. 93 schools around the U.S., we're going to have our finance curriculum. And, part of that blessing, you know, I remember thinking, like, I don't know how to put it, but I wanted it enough to make it happen. But in that one, I remember that I was fighting up against people who did not believe in our children. So the people I was bumping heads with the first year, January 25th, 2017, was the first day that I started pushing my finance curriculum into the school. That's this year. And,
you got 93 schools this year?
Yeah. God is good. So, but I push. And I push and I don't accept no. So, you know, I went to certain schools, I stayed in Brownsville and East New York and, you know, some of the inner city schools, because I wanted to make sure that it wasn't just the affluent schools that were getting this information. You know, and then as I was going into these schools, now I had an insider friend from the DOE teach me that a lot of the schools get budgets that they return. So I was like, why are they returning money? Right? That doesn't make sense. So my attack plan, because, you know, I'm a tactical person, I said, you know what? I'm going to go after the people who return budgets twice, knowing that the DOE, if they do it a third time, will probably lower their budget. So I went to those schools and I said, hey, you know, you're going to get your budget lowered if you don't spend it. Let me help you spend the budget. So some schools, you know, looked at me like I was a little crazy. And then certain schools, the principals were like, our kids are not smart enough to get this. You know, meanwhile, some of the kids are in the 6th, 7th grade, some of them are in high school, and they're like, oh, our 6th graders are reading at 3rd grade level.
Yeah.
I said, what do you mean you're sixth graders? And then I, you know, so then schools were telling me no. Then I went to Far Rockaway. People were like, Jitali, you don't want to go to Far Rockaway. It's scary out there. And I was like, you know what? Black people, they're my color. I'll be fine. I'm like, I'm mixed with Jamaican. My family's from Tivoli. We're good, man. So, you know, I'm like, if I can handle Tivoli, I can handle anywhere, right? So we go to Far Rockaway. The kids are a little bit rough. And then I get in the classroom, and the kids can't spell the word order. O-R-D-E-R. They cannot spell that word. And it hurt me, because I'm like, where's the money going? Then you talk to the principals of some of these schools, and then the principals are like, oh, well, you know, I don't think my kids are good for this. We're going to just get them a basketball and a yoga class. I mean, okay, so you're going to get them athletics, but nothing fundamentally that's going to help them. Because they're institutionalizing our children. Your children are not meant to become leaders. They're meant to become followers. They're meant to work for them and become the worker bees. So when I saw that, I said, well, this is not acceptable to me. So the school in Far Rockaway did well. Then the same schools in East New York and Brownsville and a couple other schools reach out to me and they're like, oh, we heard those kids were able to do it. If they could do it, then our kids can do it. But it wasn't about the children. It was about they wanted to save face. The principals wanted to be able to say that our kids did a finance curriculum class. And it just blew my mind. But those are the people who are running the school systems that our children are subjected to. And, you know, I firmly say all the time, if you do not love what you're doing enough to do it for free, then you don't truly love it. And you shouldn't be doing it. So when I did this journey, I knew that I was going to have to do certain schools for free. I knew, especially in the inner city schools, some of these schools really don't have a budget. And the ones who don't have a budget, then I might have to donate my time. But guess what? When I get paid by a school in Malibu, California, because they have a lot of money and they just have money to throw, I'll go to your bougie kids who don't even care if I'm in the room or not. I'll teach them. But that balances out because then I'll go to my inner city schools that actually, and go to my churches and I go to my organizations and give back. So that's where that ideology comes from because you were meant to be institutionalized. So you're breaking the matrix right now, you know, I'm kind of scared of you. I might get in trouble, you know, but that's what it is. You're breaking the matrix. You're breaking society's control over you.
Absolutely. It's like almost like we're in a trance, you know, hypnotic trance. And it's almost because it's like you said, I'm starting, now that I'm beginning to question what was laid out for me to be normal, to be acceptable. And, you know, why do I have to, why, like, I thought about it this morning. I'm like, if I want to buy nice things, if I'm in a position where I can't choose to do it, that's not a good place. Like, I should be able to, if I want to go to, let's say, Saks, why should the first thing I look for is the clearance rack? I should be able to choose if I want to go to the clearance rack or if I want to go to the $5,000 rack. But if I can't choose that, I should be able to choose if I want to travel coach or first class.
So
if I want to travel coach, I should be able to choose that.
But then there's a mindset that needs to be changed.
Exactly.
Because now part of that mindset, we bring it back to investing. That's why investing is important. I tell everyone, it's a percentage. If you are getting a check each month, and let's say you're making $2,500, let's say just $2,500 a month, for instance. We're going to start there. Out of that $2,500, everyone in this room should have at least a certain percent that they put in towards savings, a certain percent that they put in towards investing, a certain percent that they put in towards donating, because believe it or not, reciprocity is truth. If you do not give back, you will not receive. Because the universe will see that you are a taker, and it will not give you anything else, because you're not giving back to the universe. Mother Nature knows its people. That's why they say there's a purge of the world right now. The world is purging itself. So don't be part of the people that get purged. You know what I mean? So, you know, and these people, society, they put everything in movies. When that movie The Purge came out, the idea of the rich and everyone having these fancy gated communities and then allowing people to become savages and hurt each other, you know, but there are little messages in all of these concepts and things that they put out there. You know what I mean? And the message is, honestly, you need to get yourself in a position that you don't need to care about who has what likes you or loves you because you are protected. You're guided by God and all the work that you've done on this earth to protect yourself. You can't expect someone else to protect you, your government, or anyone else to protect you. You have to create that path for your children, create a legacy for your children. So bringing you back to money, if you're making $2,500, I'm not telling you you need to take $500 out of that to invest. Even if you took $50 out of that money to invest in, let's say, a commodity, that goes far. You know, in my lifetime, you know, I'm in my 30s. If I look back, when I was back in the 90s, my dad bought me to go purchase gold. He was buying it in the hundreds. By the time I was in my early 20s, gold hit, I remember at one point, 1900. From hundreds to 1900, thousands. And I remember like, oh my God, like we're rich. And I'm like, I want to sell it all. My dad's like, no, you don't sell it, you hold it. You sell some, you reinvest with the money that you sold, you keep some of the profit for yourself to be happy. Because life does not mean you cannot be happy. And then the rest of that, you reinvest, right? And reinvest is diversification. You don't put all your money in one pot. So like right now in 2017, I'm telling you, whatever happened to silver being at 40, if you look at the market, the percentage of silver to gold is supposed to be a certain percentage, a ratio. The ratio is not correct currently, which means silver is underappreciated. If it's undervalued right now, it's a low amount. Silver is at, what, $14? Which means if you go buy a silver piece of coin and have a physical commodity in your hand, you might pay $17, $18 from a dealer, from a coin gallery. For $17, $18, if you hold on to it, who knows where silver's going to be in 3 years? In 4 years. Look at where gold went. If we return to the back gold backing, which is, you know, fundamentally the banking system with this whole cryptocurrency, no one knows where the banking system is going to go. If we go back to gold and silver backing, guess what? Silver's going to skyrocket. And you're going to be like, oh, I could have bought it for $14. For $50, you could have had at least two or three pieces. You know what I mean? Four pieces, five pieces. Invest. So if you don't know what your money can do, you come to someone like myself or someone else, and then you ask them, hey, I have $1,000. What can I do with this money?
That was going
to
be the question I asked you. So if someone has $1,000 in this room right now, say, what do I do with this $1,000 in terms of investment? What would you suggest?
You can go everywhere from stocks and bonds to commodities. You can buy physical commodities or you can invest in the stocks of that commodity. I personally prefer physical commodities because if the stocks themselves, crash, then whatever you have in it is gone. But if you have a physical piece of commodity, if it does come back and it does well and it flourishes, then you always have that. Even cryptocurrency, everyone's talking about the Bitcoin wave. You know, at the end of the day, look at Litecoin. Litecoin is doing well right now, but if you look at the trend, it tanks a lot. So maybe you can pay attention and wait till the next time it crashes and buy some and invest in it. And like for cryptocurrency, Coinbase is an app that a lot of people utilize. That's something you can look into. And then if you can take that 1,000 and if you want to hold on to it, even get to 5,000, at 5,000 you can start investing in real estate. So it's just more hustling, more work, but it's steps that you can do. At 5,000, you can start investing in real estate. So that's some of the options you have.
If each of us had 1,000 and we just said, hey, let's form a group, we're going to put 1,000 each together, 5,000.
That's what the Jewish community does.
So talk a little bit about that, because from my understanding, even Jewish schools ask you to come in and teach their kids.
Yeah, so this year when we went live with our book, we have a girl on the cover with a hijab, which is, you know, what the Muslims wear on their head. And we had a few Arabic, Muslim, and Jewish schools reach out and say they thought that was amazing. And then after reading the book and getting my curriculum, a few Jewish schools now have asked me to come into their school system to teach their kids. And thank you. And the thing that got me about that is I didn't know it because I'm not Jewish. But they start their kids at 9 years old. So I'm talking to the rabbi, and he's like, oh, well, you know, all of our schools around the whole world start at nine. 9 years old, start teaching financial literacy at 9 years old to their kids. So even if a kid does not become an accountant, they all have that capability and that knowledge, the base knowledge, because they were taught that in a school system. It's mandatory in every Jewish school.
Wow.
Do you understand that? And then I had a Jewish kid that I was friends with, that I did, when I worked at Credit Suisse, he worked with me. And I remember I was talking to him, and he was like, well, my dad's a multimillionaire, but he didn't give me not a dollar. And I made it myself. I said, okay, how did you do it? And he said, well, I took my first $10,000 that I saved, and I teamed up with 10 other blokes, and they put in $100,000 and bought a commercial property building in Brooklyn, a brownstone. And then they kept, three of them kept apartments in it to live in themselves. And then the others kept the money because they wanted to do residential, like basically to just get the profit. But with that collective that they created, they bought a building, they rented it out to people, and they had rental income coming in. And now that building that they purchased, I think he said for $500,000, is worth like $3.2 million in Brooklyn. But this is the kind of things that the Jewish community teaches their children, collective, you know? It's even like the food thing that they do. I don't know if any of you have ever been near Williamsburg. You see the Jewish cars lined up and the Jewish police protecting them, and they have boxes that they're receiving. In the boxes is food. The richer Jewish people pay about $500 a month, and the poorer Jewish people, some of them pay only like $30 or $40 a month, but they're still getting enough food for their whole family. Right? So there's stuff like that for the black community and for regular people. It's not necessarily only for the black community, but we have options like that where you tell them what you make weekly and you can go and you donate your time for 2 hours. It's a food co-op. So food co-ops are amazing. Yes.
So you're saying we can make that ourselves?
You could do that yourself. Create your own food co-op. Because the Jewish have their own food co-op. If the end of the world happens tomorrow, they're going to be good because they have their own farms and their own money and their own food coming in. And they understand the trickle effect of reciprocation once again. The richer people are paying for the poorer people to be able to bank up and bring themselves higher up.
And that's in the Bible. Wow. Wow. You guys hearing this? All right. I feel like some of you guys have some questions. My last question that I'm going to ask you guys, allow anyone else. As parents here, for example, what should a parent begin to do with their child at home in order for them to begin to develop them financially?
Awesome question. First thing I think parents need to tell their children is explain depreciation to your kids.
Can you explain that to us?
Depreciation is the concept that everything that you have has a value. Some values increase afterwards, which is appreciation, and some values after you purchase it might depreciate, right? So if your child loves Jordans, every time I go into a school, especially the public school system, I always say, who has the most expensive Jordans on? Who has Jordans for $300? And the kids are quick to raise their hands. Me, me, me. And you know, like, so let's say your Jordans cost $350. And then I explain to them, do you know that because you wore them and because they got like inspected up on them, now your Jordans are only worth about $50, $60 on eBay. And then they always go, what? Don't insult me. No, I spent $350 on these. I'm like, your parents did, but okay. And, you know, they get so offended. And then I tell them, well, pull out your phones. Everyone has a phone. Go on Google. Go on eBay. Look for your sneakers that you have on. And then 9 out of 10 times, they're like, oh, my God, I'm never buying Jordans again. And then I tell the kid, it's not about you not buying Jordans. It's about knowing to invest it wisely. So next time, buy the Jordan, the special edition, when it's sold out, which is, like, usually within a week or two, you sell it while it's sold out in the box, crisp. Then you're selling it for double to triple the amount on eBay or wherever you want to sell it. And then you take the profit and you buy it when it comes back out in another 2 weeks. And then you take that other half of it and you reinvest and buy another pair of Jordans you're going to flip. So it's about changing their mind frame. So depreciation is important because our kids, the money doesn't mean anything to them. The credit and the debit cards don't mean anything to them. They don't understand the APRs and interest yet. Although it's important for them to understand it. But the first step of that lesson is teaching them that everything you buy can increase in value or decrease in value. So let them know that, hey, do you want to buy something that's going to increase in value? Do you want to invest your money properly? And the next thing I would say is taxes. You know, there's basics. Like, I have a picture book January 1st, we're going to be releasing for little kids ages 2 to 10. And one of the stories, a little girl has a $20 bill. She goes to buy a toy that's $19.99. With New York taxes, it comes out to $21.78. And she's like, what? And she's furious because she's like, now her $20 is not enough to buy what she wanted. But in that 2 seconds of that little story, all of our kids, even at ages 2, 3, 4 years old, can start understanding the game. And then in that same story, the lady goes, well, let me see if I have a coupon for you. And the coupon helped to bring the toy down to $17.78. So now she saved $3. She was, you know, she said $4, and she's extremely happy because now her $20 is enough. And, you know, it gives the child the mindset of coupons. Let's look for the bargain. So now your kid's going to start thinking about, mommy, is there a coupon for that? You know what I mean? And everyone in here, I hope, as adults, are looking at coupons, because the amount of money I save a year on just coupons alone. So that's kind of the basis, I would say, to start with your children, understanding the financial terms. And you as parents, knowing that at 13 years old, you can start building your child's credit. I mean, I was telling you about that, but most people don't know. You know, it's as easy as even their allowance, putting it on a prepaid card for them, and allowing them to only have that limit to spend monthly, but they're building their credit because it's under their name, and you're paying it. So it doesn't even matter if you as a parent have bad credit or not. So I guess those are the main things for today.
Wow. Hope y'all taking notes. So some of this is in the book, right?
Well, that book is a story form book, so it touches upon depreciation and the barter system. And the concept of that book, basically, 8 kids, as you see them, diverse kids. The leader is Ari, who's a Nigerian, Cape Verdean kid. And he teaches his friends about money, how to make their money go further. And they want to purchase a game console for $500. Their parents say no. And the kids have to come up with ways to become entrepreneurs and make the money themselves. And then afterwards, they decide, like, do we really want to spend $500 8 times on buying this game? Or do we want to purchase 1 or 2 consoles instead and then find a way to make money off of that one console that we purchased? But it just kind of shows the kids a different way of thinking. So that's the book.
Nice. And this is for what age group?
That book is for ages 8 to 18. Because I'm in the school system, the DOE told me that I had to write 12 to 17 because they don't understand that some of our kids at 8 are reading books like Harry Potter. You know, I don't think the DOE realizes the level of genius that we have when it comes to our Black community, especially. And, you know, one thing I would like to say before I forget is we have an entrepreneur challenge. It's called the Kidpreneur Challenge. And kids are writing business plans around the U.S. So anyone in here, your kid can submit. And if their business plan wins, ages 6 to 11 can win $2,500, and 12 to 17, 18, if they're still in high school, can win $5,000 towards their business. And we don't just give them the money after they write the business plan. And even if they don't know how to write it, we help them learn how to write the business plan. And then we have like 5 people on my team. And then afterwards, we help them if they need a manufacturer. We've been talking to manufacturers to lower the price. If they need a patent attorney, we have a patent lawyer who's a Black man who's willing to take lower his price to help young children get their own patents. We teach the kids about trademarking and copywriting and protecting their work, because everything you do is protection in this world. So if you're not protecting your art, then you're basically saying nothing because you're allowing someone else to come in and steal it from underneath you. So we teach our children that. And so if any of you your children ages 6 to 18 want to enter the competition, definitely go on my website, which is kidswhobank.com, and then you'll be able to submit them.
Amen. Any questions?
Hat in the back.
To see 2 hands.
Okay.
Wait for the mic.
Thank you. For kids, right? What do you think is a better way? Put it like this: allowance versus having kids earn their money. Which one do you think is more efficient?
I think it's a mixture of both. Personally speaking, I feel like your allowance. Maybe I'm wrong, but I thought your allowance period is you earning your money. I don't think any kid, rather it's doing your bed or just getting good grades in school. There's just certain levels, you know. I mean, me as a parent, because I'm West Indian, I'm like, you have to make your bed. My son is 2, I make him pick up all his car toys and put them in the bucket before he can get even a treat. Amen. You know, so no matter how young the child is, we can start, you know? So once we start with that, like my son knows he has a dollar toy budget. When we go to Stop and Shop, we go once a week, he knows he can get one toy. So it becomes a thing for him when he sees a second toy he likes, he'll hold both, and he'll figure it out. But already at two, he knows that he's only allowed one toy when we go to Stop and Shop once a week. You know what I mean? So it's really training and habit. So to me, an allowance is whatever you want your child to do with that time frame, with that budget. But, you know, definitely start getting your kids to understand the barter system, the star system, create a chart, do some dishes, you know, wash some clothes. I start them from young, you know. So my son's already washing cars and stuff. I put him to work.
Wow. Another question. What are some cool ways you think that we can have our kids manipulate their money at an early age? Since they're saving it or, you know, earning it, how could they manipulate, learn to manipulate their money?
The book is a good start. the next step, I think, you know, is really having them invest in things that they like. So, for instance, with my younger nephews when they were like, and my nieces when they were like 5 and 6, we would show them a stock of, like, let's say they wanted sneakers. What's your favorite sneaker store? Let's see if it has a stock market ticker. Let's invest in that. You know, as well, we find what they like and we find ways to help them hone it. So, like, one of the kids that entered the competition, he was allergic to everything, and he wanted to find something, a way to, like, beat that allergy but have soap that smelled good. So we were able to say, okay, well, how about if you're able to do X, Y, and Z with your money and save $500, we'll give you the other $500 so you can have enough to buy enough product to make your own soap, and then we'll help you to market it and make flyers and sell your soap. So I think when kids, when you give them financial incentive, that helps as well. Another thing we do with kids in our family, we tell them, hey, you know, weekly your allowance is, let's say, $20. If you can get to $100 this month saving your money, then we'll match your $100 and put $200 in your bank account. You know what I mean? And it's something that you technically would do for them anyway, but now you're letting them understand and know the bang for buck. And then when they're about to buy a toy, wants versus need charts are important. At the time your child can request an item, they need to start having a want versus need chart. So you put that up on a wall, and you let them know, okay, you wanted this. This was the beginning balance that you had. If you buy this toy, you're only going to have $10 left. Visualization is everything. Because when kids realize that, hey, out of my 100, I'm only going to have 20 left, they start thinking twice about, do I really want to spend money on this? You know what I mean? Even when I go to the grocery with my nieces and nephews before I had my own child, they would see auntie. I'm the fun auntie. Auntie has money. No, auntie's money. So we go to the supermarket, they're picking up things and they're throwing it into the cart, and the cart is like full with cereal and bread and cookies and chips, and my item costs like $10. And I'm looking at them like, okay, so we get to the register, and I'm like, well, I know you each have like $50 in your pocket. And then they start taking stuff out the cart. Oh, wait, you're not buying it for us? I'm like, no. You know what? We have another pack of chips at home that's still open. We'll finish that chip first. You don't want the cereal anymore. But that's the thing. Kids are like that. When they think they can take you for a ride, why not? The same way adults are. If any man or woman in this room could take another person for advantage, you would hope that their heart is good in it. They won't do it. But you can't trust that. You have to be in a position that you protect yourself at all times. Because not the outside world, this is right here at home, is your family. But the outside world is not necessarily your family. So you have to always protect yourself. That's it.
Last question for right now.
Okay, listen. Wait, hold on.
What about like entrepreneurship? What about starting your own business? What age do you think, or should we? How important is it? How important is it for kids to start their own business? Something as simple as a lemonade stand. And what age should they start that at?
3 years old. 3 years old because they have full capacity. They can make tea. They can start stirring. They can start making their own peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. They can barter their toys away. Like in my picture book, two of the kids are young little kids, and they bartered their toys and they exchanged toys. So 3 years old. And it's very important.
Wow.
You had a question?
For sure.
Oh, wait, sorry. Yes?
Wait, Mike.
Oh, thank you. Do you work with adults?
I do work with adults. At first, I did not because I didn't want to. I only love children. But after I went into the school systems, it's like what you said earlier, I realized that there was a need for adults to have this information. So we have financial workshops where we have influential people. You know, we've had Shaka Pilgrim, who's the president of Roc Nation, Jay-Z and Beyonce's label. We've had Sean Money, who's the creator of G-Unit, co-creator of G-Unit. We've had Morgan Stanley, president of Morgan Stanley. We've had a plethora of influential people come out and speak to people. And then individually, I will do one-on-one trainings with certain people. But, you know, depending how much need they have or that they need. And then if I can't, you know, live up to their standard, depending if they need me, like, all the time, then we have a financial advisor on my team that's kick-ass and has made a lot of athletes and people millions of dollars, and she's willing to donate her time as well.
So we can connect with you after if we're looking to
you. Definitely.
Thanks, Posh. So, okay, this is going to sound crazy, but is it wrong, because I'm big on, like, I don't have kids yet, but I already have a system that this is what my kids are going to learn. Is it wrong to tell my kids don't ask for one, ask for two, one to rent, and one to use?
It's not wrong, but at that same point, you also want to teach your children to live within their means in a positive way. In the sense that we don't want to put our fears or our thoughts or our energies onto our children. We want to allow them to blossom. So we kind of teach them basics or give them a base. So you can teach a child, like, hey, you should, but then we don't want to tell them you have to. So as long as you kind of make sure you structure the way of whatever you're doing in a way that they can learn from you and not be part of your fears, right? I think that's the only important thing to me as a parent is I've seen what happens when we tell our children, you have to do this, you have to do that, you have to do this. Then sometimes they look at us like, you know, they want to be defiant just because, but sometimes when we give them the options when it comes to purchasing, you know, it's also the thing. But it's also a mind frame. So when you keep telling them, hey, this is a negative if you don't do it, trust me, that goes way further than telling them that they have to do something. Because when you tell them you have to do something, they understand the reasoning behind it. They're just kind of like, why? You know? And why is such an important question that kids ask. And it's great. It's an amazing thing. You know, like I heard a parent the other day, oh, you ask so many questions. No, this is what we want them to do. We want them to challenge us. We want them to ask questions because that's what's going to propel them to become leaders. You know what I mean? So that'd be my only thing, is making sure that you don't stifle them or try your best not to stifle your child. But it's good. Create a system. You know, and throughout time, guess what? That system's going to change and it's going to evolve the same way science changed. One day Pluto was a planet, one day it wasn't, right? That's life. But it's the same thing with children, I would say.
Beautiful.
Did you?
Last question.
Her. Right there.
My question is, for those of us who have no idea about investing our money and buying stocks and all of that, would you recommend that we see a financial advisor, or we don't have that kind of budget, saying we don't have $1,000, but I got $200 that I've saved up, and I want to invest that. Like, what's the next step we can take to even start?
Okay, so the first thing I would say is that even with $200, I would say first, take maybe $50 and invest in a penny stock. Penny stocks are a good starter to learning stocks, especially if you don't have more money to play with. And the second thing is, like my nephew, the way I taught him about the stock market is read the news, see what is happening. You know, with him, the way he wanted his stock is, I told him, if Clinton becomes president, pick a stock that will do very well because she's a proponent of that particular market. And if Trump becomes president, pick a stock that will do well if he became president. So he picked a fracking company. And then he was like, Auntie, I feel bad because fracking is so bad. It's bad for the nature, for environment. I was like, well, you think rich people are looking at, oh, this is bad for the environment? And, you know, and he invested his money. And then as Trump started to pick up in numbers, his fracking company started going up. And then when Trump became president, fracking went through the roof. And it came from 29 cents to $2.89. So, you know, and he bought stocks in that, and he sold it. Once he hit 10,000, he was like, I don't care what happens next. Have your number. So when you invest your $50, have a number that once this stock has reached a certain limit, that you're willing to sell it and be happy no matter what it goes to next. Have that number. Look at the market. Do your research as far as what is doing well right now. And that's going to kind of take you to the next level. Yeah. Depending on your budget. You have to stay within budget. Everything is budget in life. If you have $10,000 and you want to invest $5,000, you could have multiple investments with that $5,000, but remain within your budget where you're comfortable. And also have a budget amount that you're willing to lose, because no investment, technically speaking, is definite. Everything, rather, is in yourself, your own business, whatever you're doing. So I always say that just be comfortable with knowing that, hey, I'm investing $5,000, but out of that $5,000, I might lose $3,000. Have a comfortable amount. Because when you prepare for the worst, when the best comes, you'll be happy. But honestly, we're all in the game of trying to win. So I really feel like if you do your research, chances are you won't have to lose, period. I will say, though, I personally don't do more than 3 to 4 investments. Like this year in real estate business, for instance, I'll just put it out there, but like I did $182,000 in real estate this year, right? Out of that money, I had a market amount that I was going to spend and I wasn't going to exceed no matter what kind of good deal came my way, right? Once I hit that limit, I was like, I'm not going to be greedy. I don't want to overextend myself because these are properties I'm going to either have to flip or that I'm going to have to monitor, and I know what else I have on my plate. I can't go beyond my limits because, yeah, I want that money and I want to be able to recoup more in real estate, but then I also know how much energy I'm willing to put into it, you know? So if you're not willing to put the energy into it, be careful how far you diverse you go, and even with the budget, stick to your budget. Don't get caught out in a hype. Tabitha. Oh, real estate is like number 3 for me. Like when it comes to my investing, personally, my business.
Oh, sorry, what's
1 and 2? My business, Kidpreneurs Financial Literacy Initiative. When I walked away from corporate America, that was business number 1 for me. Number 2 for me is, I guess, it's commodities. Because I gold backing, got physical and stocks, online stocks, but physical gold and silver and, you know, mercury, uranium, whatever, mining, oil, you know, even investing in China's bank. China has their own bank now, and American government lost a lot of money because China created their own bank, and now a lot of European banks are going to China's bank. And the dollar, they're no longer doing the dollar backing around the world, they're doing the yen and the euro backing now. So I knew that was going to happen. I've been watching it for 5 years. When I heard China was opening a bank, and I knew America owned China a lot of gold, I was like, I'm going to go invest in China's bank. So to me, investing in trends and what I'm noticing around the world is very important. And real estate is 3rd for me. And the reason why real estate is top 3 for me is because it's created platforms for me to switch money. And it's not just here in America. Like, you know, this year, 2018, God willing, I'm looking for my first property in South Africa. You know, there's just diversification. I currently own a flat in England, in Manchester, where I'm from. You know, I keep it, I rent it out with Airbnb. You know, there's always, you need to have backups. Real estate is a very good backup. It's a headache of a backup, which is the reason why it's not top 2, because, you know, it's work. You gotta, you know, even with pre-foreclosure, one of the main things I do with real estate is I find my real estate through pre-foreclosures. So I had a friend that was really nice enough to bring me under his wing, and he taught me how to find a pre-foreclosure. He taught me acris.com, or is it acris.gov, A-C-R-I-I-S. When you go on their website, it's a government site that basically tells you where every pre-foreclosure, every foreclosure any person in this room right now, you give me a name and I go on that website, I can tell you where you live, if you owe money on your property, if you've ever foreclosed, if you ever had a pre-foreclosure, if your property is unstable, if it's an abandoned lot, all of that information is on our website. So through that website, I would be like a geek sometimes till 3 a.m. on that website looking to see what abandoned properties were near me that I could physically go look at, see what kind of squatters were there. I would pay a squatter $1,000 and I would have the whole property because the property owner was like, oh, I can't deal with these people. They're not leaving. And honestly, most homeless people, you give them like $500 sometimes and they leave. And once they leave, they cannot legally come back if you change the locks. And if you fix the windows and change the locks, the squatters come back. I've purchased properties for $10,000 that were worth $200,000 just because there was a squatter and it was abandoned lot off of that website. So real estate is a very powerful tool. You just have to be patient and willing to make the calls and do what you have to do to get the deal.
Good.
Yep, making the calls is very important in real estate. I can't emphasize, like my nephew, he called 102 people before he was able to find a woman in Newark, New Jersey who sold her property to him for $15,000 because the bank, she owed the bank $9,000 and she didn't want to lose it completely to the bank, but she didn't have $9,000 to keep her property. And her property was worth $189,000. But she had poor credit, so she couldn't get a modification and our second loan. And for $9,000, she was about to lose a property that's worth $189,000 to the bank. And then my nephew calls and she's like, I'll give it to you for $15,000. I just want some money so I can move and stuff. And then we had the property. And that's with us not even fixing it. It's worth that money. So, you know, but that was 102 calls. How many of us, we want the money, but how many of us are willing to actually make the calls? Who's going to do the work? You know what I mean? Exactly. So when we say the government's not doing what we want them to do, and when we say we don't make the money that we want to make, and we're not happy with where we are physically, what are you doing to change that and to change your situation? You have to put in the work. That's the only way it's going to really happen.
So my, you heard about what we're doing here with the real estate.
Yes, I know
David
and Jermaine.
Yes.
Very well.
So what's your thoughts on it as we close?
That's
is that
awesome.
A great idea for us?
That's great. Collective is important. The Jewish community. I reference them because they have their ish together. The Arabic community have their ish together. They do it. The people who have their, the Indian community. Have you ever noticed, if you live in an Indian neighborhood, they have like 8 different families in one house. And then the person who owns the house is getting paid like $3,000 from each one. So he's banking up off of their back. They're basically thinking like, we're doing good because we're only paying $1,600 a month or whatever for rent. Meanwhile, 8 people paying you $1,600 and your mortgage is only like $2,000. Everyone bonds together to make money, especially when it comes to real estate. Why aren't we doing the same? Yeah.
Making the calls and getting the inventory, that's what we're doing. You guys don't know that, but we have lists now that's gone up from 200 to 900 where we're setting up my house. I told you I just moved. The living room of my house is being transformed into the call center, basically. So that's the part of the of what we're giving to you guys that makes it so special, because that is the hard part, getting the inventory. And I just got the extra lines put in at the house, and next week, that's what we're going to start doing. It's just making the calls to find these properties. So, like she said, it's one of those things that when we find the property, you guys have to be ready. If I find something in New Jersey that's worth $200,000 and they'll give it to you for $10,000, but you don't have a group, you don't know what you want to do, it's going to go to someone else.
100%. You can't sleep in real estate. You know, you have to be ready and have the money there, and you have to do your research. Don't sometimes jump too quickly, because sometimes you see a good deal and we're like, oh, I just got to jump on it. Check it out. Look at it. Look at the property comparables. You know what I mean? That's so important. And then you invest, and you invest your heart away. And it's good to be a collective. Just make sure the paperwork legally is set up properly so that you're protected, and that if whatever happens, you get your money and you get what you're comfortable with. But at the end of the day, collective is important. Because in the Jewish community, as I said, everyone who has their ish together, everyone who's doing well, when you look, every time you see these brick mansions coming around, coming up and being built around all of us, who's doing that? The Indians, the Jews, the Russians, the Italians, everyone who's doing it, everyone exactly.
Well, it's our turn now.
So it's the black person's turn. It's the black person.
I said it's our turn. Come on.
100%.
Exciting times. Come on, let's all stand, everybody. Come on, let's pray into this. Can we give the top?
This concludes another life-changing teaching from Hungry for God Church. For social media updates and more teachings from our pastors and leaders, please visit our site, h4gchurch.com.